please, to chapter 6. Chapter 5 ended in verse 23 with the following words. It says, "He will die for lack of instruction, and in the greatness of his folly he will go astray," or literally, "he will reel." So the picture that chapter 5 ends with is a man reeling through life. And then in chapter 6 we have some concrete examples of that. First of all, we had the concrete example of stumbling through life in 6:1 through 5 with the individual that co-signs financially. Then we stopped last week with the 6th through 11th verse, which is a man reeling through life because he procrastinates. He does nothing, or he is a sluggard. And we went through verses 6 through 11 and concluded there last Sunday. Now we do have about 9 points from the rest of the book of Proverbs. The sluggard is mentioned approximately 17 times in the book of Proverbs, and we want to note 9 things about him that are important. I was given a little cartoon this week that is, I think we ought to put on the bulletin board. It's out of the Kansas City Star. It's Gwendon, and perhaps you caught it. It's a couple that are sitting with their feet upon a desk, and the house is obviously in shambles. And he is saying to her, "We only go around once, so let's get all the rest we can." Beautiful example of the sluggard. And that man is being portrayed narratively in 6 through 11. This is the key passage on it. We covered that last time. Let's give now a summary of the sluggard from the rest of the book of Proverbs. And then we will go to chapter 8. And in chapter 8, we'll have wisdom coming on very, very strong. And wisdom is going to address the fool. And would you believe the fool is one of the most commonly addressed individuals in Proverbs? There are approximately 50 references to the fool within the book. And by the time we have finished at noontime today, I hope we will have constructed a portrait of a fool. That way we will be able to recognize our friends and neighbors. One of the Proverbs says, "He who believes the portrait of a fool is for others is a fool." And I'll let you search the concordance to find that one. Okay. All right, portrait of a sluggard, and let's take time now to write out what his characteristics are. The sluggard, number one, is an individual who surrenders the opportunities of life by procrastination. He surrenders the opportunities of life by procrastination. He puts off continually. Over and over again, opportunities, chances to do things come across his path, but he puts them off, and he puts them off until tomorrow. Chapter 6 and verse 9. Notice in addressing him, the point is how long and when, and the how long and the when point to his procrastination, his putting off. So verse 9 of chapter 6, "How long will you lie down, O sluggard?" Emphasis, procrastination. You're putting things off. When, again with the word when, emphasis on procrastination or putting things off, when will you arise from your sleep? So the emphasis is opportunities are in front of you. How long will it be before you will get with them? A chance to do this is over here. When are you going to get out of your bed and do something? So he surrenders life by procrastination. He never manages to get anything started. He always wants a little more rest. Look, for example, at chapter 20. For the same idea. And verse 13. He wants just a little more rest, a little more relaxation, a little more sleep. And in chapter 20, verse 13, you have the straightforward exhortation, "Do not love sleep, lest you become poor. Open your eyes, and you will be satisfied with food." So the emphasis is, as necessary as sleep is, obviously, two viewpoints can be used on sleep. One is sleep is so lovely. We like it so well that we live to sleep. The other idea is that we are made to work. And the purpose of sleep is to recoup strength so we can work. In other words, the divine viewpoint on going to sleep at night would be, is my body needs to regain its energy, and I am going to sleep so that, ultimate aim, I can get up in the morning and go to work. So the aim of sleep is refreshment for work, not simply something in itself, even though sleep isn't enjoyable. And this man lets his entire life go by procrastinating and loves sleep. He wants a little more rest is all he asks for. All right, second feature of the sluggard. He is an irritation to those who have the misfortune of employing him. And I'll abbreviate it on the overhead and just say he is an irritation to his employer. Chapter 10, verse 26. Chapter 10, verse 26 uses a vivid metaphor to express the idea of irritation. It says, like vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes, so is the lazy one to those who send him. First thing, notice that the lazy one, how does he relate to the other people? Well, he relates as being sent by them. And that's why we express the idea that in some way, for some message or some job, he's been employed. And the person that has done the employing has employed a sluggard. He has sent a sluggard. And the metaphor is like vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes. And both of those obviously picture something that is irritating to us. And therefore, he is an irritation to the employer. Number three, the sluggard is a person who has nothing in life except wishes. He has nothing in life except wishes. He is not deficient in what he would like to have. He is deficient from the standpoint that he never gets it because he's too lazy to get it. And that is found in two places, chapter 13 and verse 4 first. All he has in life is wishes. 13:4, and then 21, 25, and 26. First of all, 13:4. It says, the soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing. But the soul of the diligent is made fat. And notice the emphasis is that there is continual craving. I would like to have it, but of course he never gets it because he won't work for it. So he has nothing in life but wishes. Chapter 21, verse 25, pictures him again. Verse 25 says, the desire of the sluggard puts him to death. For his hands refuse to work. All day long he is craving, while the righteous gives and does not hold back. So notice again, the emphasis is that there is continuous desire, but he never gets anything, and desire is all he lives with. Stop and think, by the way, along that line. What is it that you would really like to have in life? And then ask yourself, what plan do you have to get it? Or are you going to live with mainly desire? I want it, I'd like to have it, and there are goals there, but what is the plan to get there? And the sluggard sees what he wants, and he never gets past seeing what he wants. He has a goal in a sense of the word, and yet the plan, the schedule, the means of here is what I'm going to do now, and here is my intermediate goal, and here is my ultimate goal, at the end of which I will have what I want. All he has is wishes. Number four, the sluggard turns his life into a wasteland through procrastination. His life is pictured as a wasteland. Chapter 24, verse 30. And as we go through these points regarding the sluggard, just a little word of warning. As you identify with the various points, don't smile. You give yourself away. I'm only kidding. We can all identify with these things. Chapter 12. I'm not particularly enthusiastic about the study of the sluggard. I'll be glad when we're through with it, because every time I make a point, I come right back to some concrete thing of the past week that has put me in the category of these things. But nonetheless, they're very, very vital if we'll take them seriously. All right, 24 and verse 30, notice how he's pictured as a wasteland. It says, I passed by the field of the sluggard. And since we want to make application, I have to read this. I passed by the garage of the pastor. And you go in and fill in. Maybe your garage fits there or something else fits there. I can put it in. I passed by the upfront middle drawer of the pastor also. And you put in your own slot because, and I don't hesitate to do so because I know you have places you can plug into verse 30. And if we would all visit your house, well, nonetheless, verse 30. I passed by the field of the sluggard and by the vineyard of the man lacking sense. And behold, it was completely overgrown with thistles. Notice the emphasis here is that this man did start something. He did get up the energy to get his vineyard started. So he's at least on the road. But one of the characteristics of the sluggard is if he does get something started, you can always count on it. He'll never get it finished. So behold, it was completely overgrown with thistles. Its surface was covered with nettles, and its stone wall was broken down. When I saw, I reflected upon it. I looked and received instruction. And that might be the encouraging thing. I can say that my garage is in the condition that it's in for the benefit of the flock so they can be instructed and so they can be taught. So come by and see at any time, and then you sit down and you reflect as Solomon did and say, verse 33, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. And he assumes, therefore, that the owner of the vineyard has simply said, I need a little more time, just a little more rest instead of getting with the job. Then verse 34, your poverty will come as a robber and your want like an armed man. Emphasis is that the destruction of the sluggard comes very, very quickly. All right, number five. Number five, the path or the life of the sluggard is pictured as a path of thorns. Pictured as a path of thorns. We looked at his life as a wasteland in chapter 24. His life is a life of weeds. And now, verse 5, life is a path of thorns. Chapter 15, verse 19. You stop and think how putting off things can turn life into a path of thorns. Every way you turn, it's not a smooth road. You're continually getting trouble because of the putting off of responsibility. So verse 19, it says, the way of the sluggard is as a hedge of thorns, but the path of the upright is a highway. The emphasis is the highway is the straight and quick way to get there. However, the sluggard is always deviating and always getting in trouble. Like someone put it, if you do not have time to do the job right the first time, then how will you ever have time to do it right the second time? And therefore, the emphasis is you rush through a job, it's half done, you've got to do it over again, but you were in a hurry the first time, and now you're doubly pressed for time. And this is the emphasis on how life becomes very thorny for the sluggard. All right, number six. The sluggard, and this is a strong emphasis, we'll have these three places. The sluggard is characterized as a person who never finishes what he starts. He never finishes what he starts. And we will have that in 12:27, 19:24, and 26:15. And notice in all of these places, three passages, there will be a strong emphasis on not completing your job. Beginning at chapter 12, and verse 27. These are all vividly portrayed. 12:27 says, a slothful man does not roast his prey. The emphasis is this man has gone out and he has hunted and he was successful in the hunt and he brings his what he has captured, a deer or whatever, brings it home, And yet, somehow he never gets it cooked. And he looks in the refrigerator, and there are those nice vegetables that I went out and brought home. And I have let them sit in the refrigerator for too long, and now look at them. They're all molded, and they're spoiled, and they're wilted, and the tomatoes have rotted. I never did get to eat them because I came in, and I was very tired after I hunted. I was so tired, I went to bed, and I slept. And I love sleep so well, and it was so satisfying and so happy that the deer spoil because we never got it to the freezer. All right, chapter 19 and verse 24. These last two passages are very vivid. They both read the same, so we'll only look at one. 19:24, 26:15, both read the same. 19:24, very vivid. The sluggard buries his hand in the dish. And of course, this looks at the Middle Eastern manner of eating, which would be to take a piece of bread, equivalent roughly to our pita bread, which is used as a fork. You take the bread, it's a flat bread, fold it over the meat or the vegetable or whatever in the dish, and so you got the picture of a man who takes his pita bread and he gets down to the dish and he folds it around the vegetables. There's only one problem. He is a sluggard. And it is just too much effort to get it from the bread to his mouth. So you have 19:24, the sluggard buries his hand in the dish and will not even bring it back to his mouth. Ultimate picture of laziness. He never finishes what he starts. All right, number 7. The sluggard uses every available excuse to avoid work. He uses every excuse to avoid work. In fact, at this point, we'll find out that he gets almost ridiculous. He begins to see things and bring up in his imagination reasons not to work. We would call this he rationalizes. He thinks of things to prevent getting a job done, and that's easy to do. You think of a job to be done, and there are always all kinds of excuses. Probably one of the most standard excuses is, I've got a headache. I'm sure a headache has excused more responsibilities than any other question. And we have him in two places doing this, chapter 20 and verse 4, and chapter 22 and verse 13. He almost hallucinates. Chapter 20 and verse 4. It says, the sluggard does not plow after autumn. And the idea in that would be that after autumn, you're into the cold season. And I just refuse to get out there and work because I might get frostbite or I might catch cold or something of that sort. So his plowing is limited to the balmy summertime. And as a result, verse 4, he begs during the harvest and has nothing. Notice the emphasis. He uses an excuse to get out of work. And in the passage, he's not allowed that. The author of Proverbs says, if you are not willing to plow past autumn into the cold season, this is evidence that you are a sluggard. Chapter 22 and verse 13. This really gets wild here. It's a reason for staying in bed. He stays in bed because there are lions in the street. Chapter 22, verse 13, says, the sluggard says, there is a lion outside. I shall be slain in the streets. In other words, he uses the idea of safety in order to keep from working. There's a little slogan I've seen several places that's a good one. It's a picture of a ship. And underneath it, it says, the only safe place for a ship is in the harbor. But that's not what ships are for. And the emphasis is you can always think of some type of thing. And the emphasis here is he uses his safety as a means of avoiding work, as he did in chapter 20 and verse 4, using the cold for his excuse to work. He uses every excuse to avoid work. Number 8, the sluggard does not recognize himself. The sluggard does not recognize himself, even when he is vividly portrayed. Chapter 26, verse 13. 26:13. Now I take it in verse 13, he is in his own mind sincere. In other words, he is really seeing what he thinks he sees. The sluggard says there is a lion in the road. A lion is in the open square. And I take it what he's saying here is, I'm a realist. I see the danger that's out there. And in reality, he is not a realist. In reality, he is a sluggard. Then verse 14, as the door turns on its hinges. This is humorous. As the door turns on its hinges, so does the sluggard on his bed. Now, what is the figure intended right there? I take it the idea is that the hinge is absolutely essential for the door to function. You can't operate a door unless the door has got hinges on it. Well, this is the way the sluggard operates regard to his bed. He can't get anything done without rest. He has to have his bed. It is essential. And I take it in terms of application that in verse 14, how would you put that out to be respectable? How could you, if you were a sluggard, as we all are in some degree, how would you put out verse 14? How would you say it? You wouldn't say that I'm a sluggard and I am like a, my bed, my rest is to me like a hinge is to a door. I tell you how I would put verse 14. I can handle that verse. I'm not my best in the morning. Now, is that better? I'm just not my best in the morning, so it's best to sleep. And instead of being his best in the morning, not being his best in the morning, the point is, he is a sluggard. And then notice in verse 15, you have the repeated thing that we've also stated earlier. All right? Now, number 9, and it's very important to note, and this is true, by the way, we'll have this of the fool when we study him today, that we have the remark that there is always hope. So notice, number 9, there is hope for the sluggard. By the way, coming down where we were in chapter 26, verse 16. Notice how he does not recognize himself, how he's got it all worked out to rationalize his laziness. The sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than 7 men who can give a discreet answer. In other words, he is not objective. He does not recognize himself as he is. There is hope, and that is in chapter 6, and we will only read it because we have been with it last week, where in chapter 6 and verse 6, he is told that there is hope. He can do something. He can help himself. And it says, go to the ant, O sluggard. Observe her ways and get wise. So notice there is hope, and the hope is in looking at the ant. All right, now let's put down, and we'll make it a number 10. Let's put down a feasible remedy, something concrete that we can do to avoid being a sluggard. We closed with it last week. It is a very heavy thing. It's a very difficult thing, but very profitable. Step number 1 is part of our mental attitude, and that is learn to distinguish what needs to be done. Let's put what needs / must because of both. What needs or must be done from what we would like to do. Distinguish what needs to be done from what we would like to do. And that is important. All of us face life in the sense that there are a lot of things that we would really like to do as over against what we must do or what we need to do. I like to paint. I don't mean paint pictures, but paint walls. But I only like to paint walls if they're getting painted a different color. Why? Well, I like to see that I'm getting something done. I like to see the contrast that this is changing the room. When it comes to roll the room again in the same color because it's been bumped in various places, I don't like to do that, but it needs to be done. I like to paint the flat surface. I hate to paint the details because it's tedious, and consequently, some of my painting jobs are, I've done the big part, now the kids can finish it, you know, which means you get the window sill and all that sort of thing. And therefore, nothing wrong with having things that we would like to do, but what is the balance? Do we find our day going in the line of, all I did was what I wanted to do today, and yet over here stands what really needs to be done and must be done? Now, I think we ought to go a step further from that. Not only distinguish what needs to be done mentally and what must be done, but second, list them in order. I mean on paper. List in order, needs first. Make a concrete list. I did that this week. And I feel good about it because I listed out some of the things that in the order of priority that really need to be done, that should be done, and I put them up there at the front. I had spent, how long have we been in Proverbs? I think this is about the 28th hour we've been in Proverbs. And up until 2 weeks ago, I got nothing written on Proverbs, nothing. No, I did something. I did something on the sluggard, but I didn't finish it. And so I just simply sat down. What are you going to? What needs to be done? You need to be sure this week that you've got something done. And consequently, after last Sunday, I put down that before I teach again, I need to get done two more chapters. I need to get done the lacking sense portrait, and I need to complete out the ideal woman portrait. And I listed them, put them right in front of my desk where it would plague me every day. And you get there and you say, boy, I sure would like to do this, but the list says this needs to be done. And I got them both done this week, and I want everyone to know it. Please put that in your notes. Thank you. Okay, then third, list in order the needs first, and then plan a schedule. That's important too. The second point says, what am I going to do? The third point says, when am I going to do it? And you can go under on not getting that third one done. You can have a nice list of what I need to do. But the point is, you still have allowed yourself to imbibe in the characteristics of the sluggard because I've got my list, I know what is important and what must come first, and the list sits there. And every day you look at, here is what I need to do. And what happens? Well, a week passes and a 2 week passes because you have not locked into what you must do when I'm going to do it and put down a date for it. Schedule. I realize, and I don't want to make a type of rigidity here that will ruin things, because if you look at the life of Christ, he was flexible. How many times did you see him going in one direction and the woman came along and grabbed his garment and says, I need to be healed. And he stopped what he was doing and took time. So don't get to the point that, you know, a friend has a need and you say, I'm sorry, but the list of things I have to do says at 10 a.m. this morning, I must do this, and therefore I can't help it that you're about to perish. And I have a schedule and I can't respond to that. So obviously do not respond in a way that recognizes that when might have to be rescheduled, but if it has to be changed, reschedule it. And don't simply say, well, I couldn't get it done at 10 a.m. Tuesday, so I'll put it off because something else came up and now you're without a schedule again. Move it to 10 a.m. Wednesday or something of that sort. And then if you get about six in a row, begin to think that probably your reasons for rescheduling are not very good. This is difficult, this is hard to do, but this is one of the ways we can avoid the pitfall of the sluggard that we have in our passage here today. All right, now let's go to Proverbs chapter 8. And we have time enough in this session to take a look at a comparison, and we'll make it in terms of a chart. And on the left side, we'll put Proverbs 7, and the right side, we'll put Proverbs 8. And note two things about them. The first thing is that Proverbs 7 and 8 relate to one another in two ways. The first way is they relate in terms of total contrast. Chapter 7 and chapter 8 are diametrically opposed to one another in terms of contrast. Might put it that coming into chapter 8 is like you have been in a smoky, stuffy, overheated room. And that's chapter 7. And you step out of that room and you get a fresh breath in chapter 8. Chapter 7 pictures an immoral woman offering that which will destroy youth. In chapter 8, you have another woman. This time, it is wisdom personified, offering something gracious and something very, very, very good. The 7th and 8th chapters also have a similarity. The similarity between 7 and 8 is both of them picture a woman making an offering. But let's notice the set of contrast. Number 1, coming down to chapter 7 and verse 9. It says, in the twilight, in the evening, in the middle of the night, in the darkness. In chapter 7, this woman operates in secret. And the picture of chapter 7 is the idea of operating in the darkness, in the twilight, and so forth. In chapter 8, this woman who offers wisdom operates openly. The contrast of operating in secret and operating openly. Notice the open operation. This goes in chapter 8 and chapter 9 also. Chapter 8, verse 2. Well, let's read verse 1 to get the context. Does not wisdom call and understanding lift up her voice? Now notice the contrast. She is not in the twilight, in the darkness, in the secret places, but on top of the heights beside the way, where the paths meet, she takes her stand. And then if you go down to chapter 9 and verse 3, where she continues to address the listeners, it says, she has sent out her maidens. She calls from the tops of the heights of the cities, operation in open. Verse 14, she sits at the doorway of her house on a seat by the high places of the city. So the first set of contrast is the set of how they operate, operating in secret versus operating openly. Second, in chapter 7, the woman uses seductive speech. Chapter 7, verse 5. That they may keep you from an adulteress, for the foreigner who flatters with her words. Verse 13, she seizes him and kisses him, and with a brazen face she says to him. Verse 21, with her many persuasions she entices him, with her flattering lips she seduces him. Seductive speech. As over against the noble speech of the woman of chapter 8. Noble speech. Notice how beautifully that is emphasized in chapter 8, verse 6. Listen, for I will speak noble things. The opening of my lips will produce right things. My mouth will utter truth, and wickedness is an abomination to my lips. All the utterances of my mouth are in righteousness. There is nothing crooked or perverted in them. And so notice the second set of contrast between the speech. Third, the woman of chapter 7 offers fleeting pleasure. And the emphasis on the fleeting pleasure is in chapter 7 and verse 18. Come, let us drink of our love until morning. So notice this is a short thing, whereas in chapter 8 and verse 18, you have permanent wealth offered. Fleeting pleasure versus permanent wealth. And the emphasis on the permanent wealth is in 8:18. Riches and honor are with me, enduring wealth and righteousness. So it's enduring wealth versus fleeting pleasure. The next contrast is in chapter 7, she is the source of death. In chapter 8, she is the source of life. Source of death, 26 and 27. of chapter 7. Many are the victims she has cast down. Numerous are all her slain. Her house is a way to Sheol, descending to the chambers of death. Whereas in 8:35, for who he who finds me finds life and obtains the favor of the Lord. And then a final contrast is in chapter 7. The woman is pictured as heartless, whereas in chapter 8, wisdom is pictured as with heart. First of all, heartless, chapter 7 and verse 23. It says, until an arrow pierces his liver as a bird hastens to the snare, so he does not know that it will cost him his life. She knows that she is costing a young man life, quality of life. However, in chapter 8, verse 17, this woman says, I love those who love me, and those who diligently seek me will find me. And so we have a lot of set of contrasts. Now, one other thing that will come up in chapter 8 is in chapter 8, wisdom gets so personified that you are really forced to make a correlation between wisdom and Jesus Christ. Because reading in closing, down at verse 23, we'll deal with this next hour. It says, the Lord possessed me at the beginning of his way. Before his works of old, from everlasting I was established. Notice the eternal quality of wisdom. From the beginning, from the earliest times of the earth, when there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no springs abounding with water. Before the mountains were settled, before the hills I was brought forth. While he had not made the earth and the fields, nor the dust of the world, when he established the heavens, I was there. So notice you almost come to the point that you have got to include the fact that Jesus Christ is the very embodiment of wisdom. And as you read these verses, your thoughts are taken very much to the book of Colossians, which points out that he is the very embodiment and all wisdom exists in the person of Jesus Christ. So I take it throughout this 8th and 9th chapter, we'll have a good deal to say about how this relates to Jesus Christ. And we'll pick up with that next hour. Father, we're thankful for your word. We pray that we'll be instructed by it in Christ's name. Amen.